Well, good evening. You guys were supposed to be at Smart Road tonight. Oh. I don't believe that's the reason. Well, it's nice to be with you all tonight. Let's begin in 1 Corinthians 14, and then I'll kind of tell you. Let's turn there, and then I'll kind of tell you what I've got in mind. By the way, I really enjoyed that quiz. I've always kind of liked quizzes, and seeing the maps and those things pointed out is really nice. I kind of went around a little bit on what I was going to talk about tonight. I had decided, and then I kind of went against it this afternoon, and then decided, and I just went ahead and came back to it. And I don't know if this is a good way to introduce it, but it'll get your attention if nothing else. I may ruffle some feathers tonight. And what's that? I didn't hear it. I'm sorry, Jamie. Like, oh, did I do that this morning? You ain't seen nothing yet. And if I ruffle your feathers, what I'm going to ask is that you please, please, at least hear me out. And you measure what I say against the Word of God. Don't measure it against anything else. Measure it against the Word of God. And if the Word of God confirms what I say, I'll be glad. If it denies what I say, you let me know, please. We're going to be in 1 Corinthians 14 to begin with, and I want to notice the theme that Paul hits on repeatedly here. He's talking about prophecy and speaking in tongues, in course, and how prophecy is superior to speaking tongues. That is, unless you have an interpreter, in which case speaking in tongues is really just functionally equivalent to prophecy. But in verse 2, notice he says, "He who speaks in a tongue does not speak to men, but to God, for no one understands him." That is, if he's speaking without an interpreter. "However, in the Spirit he speaks mysteries. But he who prophesies speaks edification and exhortation and comfort to men." Verse 4, "He who speaks in a tongue edifies himself, but he who prophesies edifies the church." Verse 5, "I wish you all spoke with tongues, but even more that you prophesied, for he who prophesies is greater than he who speaks with tongues, unless indeed he interprets, that the church may receive what?" All right, we have seen this either in noun or verb form three times already now in this chapter. Edification. That is one of the major themes of this chapter. He's not done. Notice down to verse 12. "Even so you, since you are zealous for spiritual gifts, let it be for the edification of the church that you seek to excel." Okay, great. If you're wanting to excel in the use of miraculous gifts, that's fantastic, but make sure it's motivated by a desire to do this, to edify the church. Verse 17. For you indeed give thanks, well, but the other is not edified. And that's a problem. Verse 26, he says, "How is it then, brethren? Whenever you come together, each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation. Let all things be done for what? Edification." All right. So some six times in 1 Corinthians 14, Paul speaks to making sure that what you do in the church edifies, and that it brings about edification. One's a noun, one's a verb. Now, just maybe for interest's sake, let me point out to you the Greek words here. The Greek word for edification here is oikodome. The Greek word for edify, the verb form, is oikodomeo. To some of you, this might look familiar. We got any yogurt eaters in the room? Some of you might like oikos yogurt. Oikos is the Greek word for house. It may also have to do with the idea of building. Now, when you edify, what are you doing? What do we always say? Edify means to build up. If I am edifying, I am building up a building. I am edifying an edifice. And what is that building? What is that edifice? The church, sure. The house of God, 1 Timothy 3:15. And the individual members are houses in and of themselves. For if you're in Christ Jesus tonight, you are the temple of God. So we have individual temples growing into one holy temple in the Lord, says Ephesians 2. So when the church comes together, one of its chief, greatest goals is this. Building up one another. Every Christian's goal when coming to the assembly must be to allow himself or herself to be a tool of God in strengthening God's structures. Now, this does kind of bring us full circle to class this morning. Because what did Dale lead us in? Was it the 13th verse there in Colossians 3? I'm not remembering the exact verse. But we were told, after we were told what to put off, we're told what to put on. And then he says, but above all these things, put on what? Charity or love, which is the bond of perfection. What is the ultimate ingredient to making sure that I edify others? Love. Prove it. Well, obviously it's right, John. Where in the Bible would I go to prove that love is what edifies? Well, it's right in there, just before edification. That could work. There's actually a passage that outright says, knowledge puffs up, but charity or love edifies. Anybody remember where it is? A little quiz of my own. Just jump up 6 chapters back. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1. Notice Paul says there, 1 Corinthians 8:1, concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up. And we've seen that in people, haven't we? People get real arrogant. Oh, I know more than everyone else around me. Knowledge puffs up, but love or charity edifies. Now that 14th chapter, if you want to turn back there real quick, where we saw edify, edification, edification, edify, what's the first verse? What are the first two words of the 14th chapter? Pursue love. So if we want to edify one another when we come together, we must first love one another. If we want to edify one another, we must love one another. And I think it was said this morning that if we will love, all these other things will fall into place. And that might be a slightly oversimplification of it, but it is true. If love is your driving force, then yes, these things will take their place at the very least. And love does not seek its own. That's what we were told in 1 Corinthians 13. Love does not seek its own. If I love you, I'm looking out for what's best for you. The important things in your life are what I'm focused on. It's not about me. If I love you, I do whatever it takes to benefit you. It might mean keeping myself from saying something. It might mean, as Ed pointed out this morning, saying what's uncomfortable to say and for you uncomfortable to hear. It might be any number of things, but it's always looking for what is best for you. Now, interestingly, 1 Corinthians 13 tells us something else about love. If you jump over there real quick, maybe you don't even have to turn the page. 1 Corinthians 13 verse 5 tells us that love is not what? Or doesn't behave what? Rude. Love is not rude. Verse 5 right there at the beginning. Does not behave rudely. The lesson I'm presenting to you tonight, I didn't put the title on it. I was asked to address these things by a congregation quite a long way from here, but they had me entitle it this. Church etiquette. And that'll become more clear as we go along here. But love is not rude. So if we want to have good church etiquette, we need to love. And if we love, we'll edify. Now those two things, I want those to be the guiding principles for everything else we talk about tonight. And I may once in a while ask for your input, and I want you to feel free to offer it. Number one, here was one of the questions they wanted me to address. And some of these may sound, well, some of these might be real important to some of you and not so important to many of you, but let's talk about them. Something simple like this building. How do we regard this building? How do we behave in this building? I remember as a boy, and that's not been all that long ago, I know, for many of you, but it's a long time ago for me, when I was, I don't know, maybe 6 years old, maybe a little less, I don't know just how old I was. Ray Turner was still living. At the Murray Road Meeting House, Ray was standing right there in the vestibule, and I came racing through there, and I ran right between him and some other man who were having a conversation. And Ray caught me while I was running. You know, that was rude, as he saw it, and he was right for me to do that sort of thing. I don't know exactly what Ray's feelings would have been on what kind of behavior goes on in the building, but we've got different viewpoints on that, some of us, don't we? Some of us in this room may feel very, very strongly about what sorts of things the building should be used for, about how people ought to behave in the building, whereas others may feel like, it's just a building. It doesn't matter. We do know when we look in the New Testament, where was the early church meeting much of the time? Homes. Can you name me one congregation that met in a home? Or one family that housed a church in its home? Either one. All right, Priscilla and Aquila, that's right. Romans chapter 16. Romans 16, verses 3 and 5, Paul says, "Greet Priscilla and Aquila, likewise greet the church that is in their house." And interestingly, over in 1 Corinthians 16:19, it looks perhaps as if another church was meeting in their house elsewhere, possibly. Paul was writing from Ephesus, probably, and he wrote, "Aquila and Priscilla greet you heartily in the Lord." This is 1 Corinthians 16:19, with the church that's in their house. So at least one, maybe two different congregations met in Priscilla and Aquila's home in their lifetime. Can we think of another family that housed a church? What's Harris Road? That's right, that's right. I was thinking in the Bible. Remember in the book of Philemon? That's one of those books that I know that we're using all the time. But Philemon, verses 1 and 2, Paul writes to Philemon, our beloved friend, to the church that's in your house. You compare Philemon to Colossians, and it looks like it was the Colossian church that was meeting in Philemon's house. We had a church meeting in Nymphas' house. Colossians 4:15, greet Nymphas and the church that is in his house. So we see the early church meeting in homes. Are those the only places they met in? No, I wouldn't say that, necessarily. But we know they were meeting in homes. Do we have any indication in the Bible that the early church met in meeting houses like we have? I know of none. I know of none. We know they had meeting houses by the 3rd century AD when Diocletian initiated his persecution. They were destroying meeting houses. But in the first century, we don't have any record of them. Now, that doesn't make them wrong, but we don't have a record of them. Now, why might that have bearing on this question? Because a lot of the anxiety and tension that can arise in a congregation about the building arises only because we have a building. That if we were doing what those first century Christians were doing, we were meeting in homes, some of the questions that arise would not arise. They wouldn't come up. In my opinion, they would seem silly. They would seem irrelevant. They would seem obvious. But because we have these places, questions end up coming about. Let me read to you what this congregation gave me. They wrote, "Jesus scolded the money changers who were polluting the temple," in Matthew 21:13. He refers to the temple as a house of prayer. "Should not our meeting house be regarded with similar respect? Moses was warned to show respect when God's message came to him from the burning bush because it was standing on holy ground. Is there holy ground today?" You see where those questions are going. In other words, is the meeting house special? Is it holy in some respect? Should we regard the meeting house in some special, sacred way or put it up on some pedestal that we don't put other places on? And I'm not going to presume to know what everyone in this room believes. Some of you may be thinking, well, no. Others might be thinking, well, I think so, yes. I don't know where everyone stands on that question. Let me offer you a few of my thoughts on it. In my opinion, it's difficult to have much to say on the question because the Bible just has nothing to say on it. The Bible's silent on this issue. We don't have church buildings in the Bible, therefore nothing is said on the subject. We do see holy ground in the Old Testament, the burning bush, the commander of the Lord's army over in Joshua chapter 5, the tabernacle and the temple. Do we see holy ground mentioned in the New Testament? We do have a couple of instances. If you go with me over to Matthew 24, notice what Jesus says there. Matthew 24. Jesus is talking about the coming destruction of Jerusalem. Verses 15 and 16. Matthew 24, 15 and 16. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place," whoever reads, let him understand, "then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." When you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, of course, this is referring to what happened in 70 AD. Now, what's the holy place? Now, some would say the temple. I'm not so sure that's right. Because the Christians needed time to get out of Dodge before the Romans fully took the city. Notice the parallel passage in Luke 21. You can take this into consideration, see what you think. Keep your place in Matthew 24 if you want to compare the phrasing. But in Luke 21, verses 20 and 21, notice the parallelism, but what replaces holy place. Luke 21, verses 20 and 21. Now in Luke, and in Matthew 24 is when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. Notice here in Luke 21:20, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. I wonder if the holy place really is just the city of Jerusalem. When the Christians were able to look over the walls and see the Roman armies with, yes, their pagan icons out there outside of the city, then they knew it was time to flee. Whatever the case, though, Jesus does refer to a holy place here. What other place is referred to as holy in the New Testament? A geographical location. This is obscure. I wouldn't necessarily expect you to remember this, but 2 Peter 1, verse 18. Can someone tell us what other place is referred to as holy in the New Testament? In terms of geographical, physical locations. 2 Peter 1:18. Someone want to read it real loud for us?
The holy mount. And the voice was coming from heaven we heard when we were with him in the holy mount.
All right, what's the holy mount? What's Peter talking about there? Yeah, the Mount of Transfiguration. Here was God. Here was the Son of God. And this became the holy mountain. Holiness was present there. All right, so we have perhaps Jerusalem and the Mount of Transfiguration referred to as holy in the New Testament. Beyond that, however, I know of no physical geographical location ever specified as holy in the New Testament. We've got heaven called the holy place. Christians are holy. Your bodies can be holy. Their children are holy. Your kisses are holy. Your conduct should be holy. Your faith is holy. Your spirits can be holy. But again, I know of no place in the Bible where it ever says your meeting place, strictly speaking, becomes holy. So, the Bible doesn't say a whole lot about it. So do I regard these meeting houses as holy? In that they are sacred in some sense before the eyes of God? Based on what I can see in the New Testament, no. Now, holy people should be meeting here, doing holy things to a holy God with holy thoughts. But again, I see no indication that that makes the place itself holy. Now, that said, does that mean the building should just, we should treat it like any place? I'm asking you. I see people shaking their head. Why do you say that? Respect for?
Because we as holy people of God meet here.
Okay.
And respect the building. You don't come in here and tear it up. You keep it clean, you respect it, because it is a place where holy people come to worship.
Well, I honor that opinion. I honor that opinion. I'm not sure I would reason it out quite like that, but okay, fair enough. Yes, Denton. Exactly. Yes.
During the week, and then except on Sunday, then they come to church.
That's right.
Which, I couldn't think of any place using a bar or something like that or church services. But I guess it'd be a feasibility. Probably the best choice.
Probably not.
I understand Acts chapter 20, verse 7, where a young man was asleep in the window and he fell out of the window.
Right. Yes, yes.
I'm not sure they would have done that to someone's home.
Well, I don't know. Does it specify for us where Jesus was? I think it might even say a house in that instance, but I can't remember for sure. If someone could find that passage for us to confirm for us one way or the other. Because I don't remember offhand where it is.
There was apparently in Acts 27, there was an upper.
Yes, yes.
Just when I look
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. I do think, yes, go ahead, Barbara.
Well, I was just thinking, when people were meeting in homes, if you think about it in those terms, how would you act if you were in someone's home?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't, you know, do things that would desecrate that home or
that's true.
Destroy it or anything like that.
That is true. Yeah, I'm all about respecting, but see, that's about the people more than the place, isn't it? This is their home, and we want to show honor to them by honoring what is theirs. Did you have a thought, Dale?
Well, I think there's a time involved. When you set a time to come to worship, no matter where you are, it becomes set apart. That time sets the place apart.
Okay.
No matter whether it's a building, a house, a field, on the stream, you know, they met anywhere, but it was a time they set apart.
Yes.
To worship God.
Yes.
No,
yeah.
And that might make it somewhat holy wherever you are. It's
possible that it might. It's possible that it might. But beyond that, the structure itself, I mean, let's imagine we're meeting in a living room. We've got a congregation of 30 people here, and we're meeting in this big living room, but we're meeting there. Well, then the congregation leaves, and Saturday afternoon, that family has their grandkids over. Well, the kids are romping around in the living room and all that. Is this wrong? Of course not. Of course not. Well, but the church met there just like it meets here. And that's the thing I guess I'm wanting us to see, that if we weren't meeting in these buildings, but we were meeting in a school or some rented facility, I think we would view these things probably different. But I guess where I was wanting to head is I do believe the building ought to be respected from this standpoint. If we don't take care of this building, for example, what does that say? It says we're not good stewards of the blessings of God. It says that we're lazy. It says any number of things which we don't want to say. So there is that standpoint, it needs to matter. We do need to care about each other. If it is offensive to you when other people's children run in the auditorium, if it is offensive to you if a child gets up and starts speaking over the sound system, if that is something which is disturbing and offensive to you and does not make for peace, then as a parent, what's my responsibility? To stop it. Not necessarily because the building is holy, but because I want to do this. Edify, that word that was up there. I don't want to tear down. I don't want to create division and strife in the church over misbehaved children of all things. So it becomes about the people rather than the place. Now, did I see another hand over there? Yes, Janet.
Well, I was wondering if part of what you're thinking is some people might have trouble with using the building for other functions.
Yeah.
Not meeting
yeah. Yeah, and that is. And in my opinion, that's a judgment call. Kathy. Okay. Sure. And I agree with that. And I think that takes at least two forms. First of all, that we take care of it. We don't abuse it. We take care of it. And secondly, that we use it wisely when it comes to these matters of judgment. For example, strictly speaking, I do not believe it would be inappropriate for a group of young men who like to play guitars. Now, theoretically speaking, who like to get together and play guitars, if they didn't have a place to get together, to go into a meeting house, as long as the elders were informed and the elders were okay with it, to go ahead and come into the meeting house and maybe on a Friday night, do that themselves. However, there are two potential problems with that. Number one, how would a lot of members of the church feel about that? They would not like that. That's a problem. And secondly, it might send a mixed signal when my neighbors are sitting out there on their front porch Friday night and here's the Church of Christ across the street and five young guys show up and start carrying in drums and guitars. That might throw them a little bit. So That sort of thing needs to be taken into consideration. But in my opinion, I think we may be dealing here with expedient issues. All things are lawful, but not all things are expedient. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. And I want to do what's best for the members of the church, what makes for peace, and what will convey an unconfused, unmixed message to the world. I guess we come to the same conclusions in many cases, but the way we get there is different. And I think it's important that we get to the right conclusion the right way. Was there another thought? Because I want to turn my attention to something else if there isn't. Yes, Jack.
I found that out as a young one myself. You don't do that. And that's not a religious place. There are places that we honor because of the decorum itself. So whether it be a concert hall or be a public library. So I'm just thinking that sometimes it's not just the place.
Right. Yes. All right. Time, people, purpose, all of these things go hand in hand. But none of those answers have taken, well, I don't guess I need to say it. I like the thoughts. I like what you're saying. Let's move on to something else. Sometimes, you know, the issue of distraction comes up in the assembly. And some of us are more easily distracted than others. But things can be distracting. And one of the things that can often become a subject that something is distracting the assembly is our cell phones. All right. Yes. Hope I've got mine on vibrate back there. I think I do. Clothing. This becomes a topic of discussion. I have known at least one, maybe more, younger men tell me that they intentionally sat up front in the assembly so that they didn't have the ladies' clothing distracting them. This ought not so to be. But let's talk about this in a little bit. Whether you are in the meeting house or not, if you're a Christian, you are called to be modest in your dress. Where would I go to find that teaching? The Bible. We can do better than that. Come on. Where would I go in the Bible to find out that I am supposed to dress modest? All right, 1 Peter chapter 1 Peter chapter 3. And then there's one other passage, and some of you can be thinking about that while we're reading this one. 1 Peter chapter 3. And these commands are given to women. That doesn't mean that men can just be immodest and it's okay. The commands are given to women because it tends to be more of an issue for women. The command to not lust after another in your heart is given to men. That doesn't mean it's okay for women to lust after a man in their heart. It just means the command is given to the ones who are most inclined to have a problem with it. God does that all the time. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. He doesn't say mothers, don't provoke them. Mothers shouldn't, but fathers are more inclined to do it. So it's given to those to whom it's most applicable. 1 Peter chapter 3, wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. When they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. So a woman of God is to be adorned with her godliness. That's what she should be noticed for, not how fancy she dresses, Not that she can't dress fancy, but that should not be the thing for which she is known. It shouldn't be the thing that draws people's attention to her. Where's another passage, though, where the word modest is actually used? 1 Timothy 2. Let's go over there. 1 Timothy chapter 2. We get similar thoughts here, but a little bit more. Starting in verse 8. 1 Timothy 2, verse 8. I desire, therefore, that the men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. In like manner also, that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, or in verse 9, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. With good works. Now, by the way, I am not of the understanding, at least at this point, that Paul is necessarily ruling out the things he lists at the end of verse 9. Like the gold and the braided hair and so forth. Remember what Jesus said in John 6. He said, do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life. Now, if we take do not literally there, that would mean that I'm not supposed to work to eat. But is that what God wants? No. What's the point of that passage? Yes, it's not to be the priority. Do not make this your priority, but this instead. Paul says God did not send him to, or he was not sent to baptize, but to preach. Now, we've got religious friends who will say, aha! See? He wasn't sent to baptize. But is that his point? No, that's not his emphasis. Baptism's secondary. Let's get the message out first. I think the same thing may be happening here. Not that a woman cannot address herself in nice clothing, but that it should not be the focus. Her focus should be being adorned with good works. Now, what's the word modest mean? Let me ask you, what's the word modest mean?
Not overdone.
Not overdone. Okay. Any other thoughts? Not calling attention to yourself.
Not obnoxious.
Not obnoxious. Okay. You look up the word modest in the Greek, and one dictionary I consulted says, pertaining to being appropriate. What's appropriate? What's appropriate? I don't know how many, young ladies. We've got a few young ladies in the room, and maybe this is something that can cross the minds of an older ladies as well. And I'm not making a distinction where that begins and ends. But let me ask you this. I don't know if you ever heard me tell the story. When Amber and I were younger, and we had one, maybe two children, we used to go to the YMCA. We were real gung-ho young parents. You know, our kids were going to learn to swim before they could even talk and all this stuff. We were at the YMCA, and Amber was wearing not a swimsuit, but a shirt and some shorts about down to her knees in the pool. We'd done this, I think, before, and it had never been a problem. But for whatever reason, the lifeguard came up to her that day. And he was probably just following the rules. He was a young man. He says, you can't be in the pool in clothes like that. And she just responded. She goes, well, what about modesty? And he goes, what's that? He wasn't being snide about it, that I recall. I just maybe didn't know. This word, and I guess I'm going to address this to the young ladies. And I don't need an answer, but I just want you to think out loud. When you hear this word, modesty, and you've got this man who doesn't understand up here talking to you about modesty, when many women, not you maybe, but when many women today hear the word modest, what does it mean to them? Do you think it might mean this? Ugly.
Old-fashioned.
You know, I don't claim to understand all things about the other gender. I saw a joking thing today. This guy was sitting there with this book about this high and said the book on understanding women had just come out. And here he was with these, you know, tens of thousands of pages. We can understand each other enough to work with each other and love each other and appreciate each other. But we are different. And I do think, and correct me if I'm wrong, ladies, but I do think that probably in general, a woman, older or younger, wants to feel pretty. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing at all wrong with that. But it is important that we define pretty within the parameters of the will of God. And I hope that we can, if we're feeling this way, we can stop feeling this way. You know, if I'm a man or a woman, but particularly a woman, if I'm dressing and I'm showing a lot of skin, and I'm wearing tight clothing that's revealing, and by revealing, let me be clear, Facebook, I'm going to mention it again. I've seen a picture or pictures on Facebook of women who call themselves Christians, who've got plunging necklines where I'm able to see the beginning of their chest. This is not edifying. This is not loving. This is immodest, I believe. But when, and by type, let me explain what I mean by this. And I got help from my wife on this one. She's a good thinker. I'm going a little outside the box here, but just stick with me. She said she finally figured out, I guess talking with me and just thinking about it, and that tightness becomes an issue, and I'm not going to describe this in detail, but tightness, in her opinion, became an issue when the clothing begins to reveal the bottom of the curve, if you know what I mean. I thought that was insightful. As a man, I admit, I think there's some truth to that. God did make us in a certain shape. Clothing's going to reveal that shape to an extent. But when certain kinds of clothing begins to show more of the curve than some looser clothing would, that's when it can become a problem. Now, if I'm a young lady or an older lady, I mean, again, I don't know exactly where we want to draw all these lines, but if I'm a woman and I dress in a way that is too tight, that does show too much skin, I don't necessarily mean to do this at all, but what message do I send? And men, maybe you could help us out, because the message comes through to we men. What message do we get?
Look at me.
And look at me for who I am, right? No. Look at me as a piece of meat. And I want young women to understand this, that you make yourself an object of lust, yes, but you make yourself just an object, a thing. That young man who's looking at you in that outfit which you feel is so pretty, but which is really immodest, he's not looking at you for you. He's not saying, boy, she has nice feminine beauty, like he might say if you were wearing something more modest. He's looking at you and parts of you that you don't really want him looking at. In a way, you definitely do not want him looking at. And you can't imagine the sorts of things that are going through his mind. I've heard a woman say that you can't really know how a man thinks until you get married. And maybe there's a measure of truth to that. Okay, that's not where I wanted to go the whole time, though. We do need to keep that in mind. But there's one other aspect I want to talk about. Please bear with me. I spent too much time on the other stuff. And this is where I'm going to ruffle feathers. All right. Okay, John, I agree. We should all be dressed modestly, man or woman. We should be dressed modestly outside the assembly, inside the assembly. But when we come into the assembly on Sunday morning, John, we need to be dressed in our best. And if you are of that opinion, I'm going to ask you to bear with me while I call it into question. I'm going to call it into question from a couple of standpoints, and the first of them is, what is our best? What is our best? What's the rationale? Whether this is your opinion or not, the argument is made, I need to come in my best. Why? And I'm trying to be fair here to those who hold this view, whether you're one of those people or not. The argument that I need to dress my best on Sunday morning, what's the rationale behind it? Okay. Well, some might answer that way. I'm trying to think from the positive standpoint. Those who would make a spiritual argument in favor of wearing your best on a Sunday morning. And I imagine we've got some in the room this morning. All right, giving your best to the Master. That we're coming to worship God. This is serious business. I need to bring my heart ready, and I need to bring my best to service to God. That's the argument that's made. And if you feel strongly about that tonight, and I say nothing to make you consider otherwise, then please continue to do it. And those of us who don't necessarily feel that way, we need to honor and love and respect and let it go. But let me say that I think that word best is a very slippery term. Do we have any, don't raise your hand, but do we have any men in the room today who have an Armani suit? Okay, I don't even know how much one of those things would cost. In fact, I wouldn't even know one if I saw it, but I hear about Armani suits as if it were a big deal. I'm pretty sure that even if you don't have one, we've got many men in the room today, maybe all of you, who could afford one. No? How much is an Armani suit? Well, that's true of this tie I bought yesterday. $1,000? Okay. All right.
More like three.
All right. Many of you in this room could afford an Armani suit. Now, you make the decision not to because it seems outrageous to you. And I tend to agree. But if it's really about giving our best to the Master, and service to God is all about sacrifice, then wouldn't it logically follow that I go out and find the very best kind of clothing that there is that I can afford, and I buy that and bring it to God on Sunday morning? But we don't do that. Our best is what's the best thing we have in our closet, which isn't the best thing we could bring. We could buy a nicer suit. We could, we could get a tuxedo. Ladies, we could get a nice dress that was modest. We could go to more trouble than we do. We have settled for what is best in our closet, and that's our best. We could do better, but we're satisfied with that. And I think we're satisfied with that because it's really not about what's best. It's not about what's best. It's about a tradition. It's about something that got started I don't know how long ago, and it got passed down to us. And we were told this is the way it ought to be. And human beings generally tend to take what they were told and do it and pass it on to the next generation. I have a poem in front of me I'd love to read, but for time's sake, I won't do it. But I would like to take you to 7th chapter of Zechariah, and we'll close here. Would you go there with me? Because this issue of tradition is addressed in that chapter, Zechariah chapter 7. In a way that I don't know if it's addressed this way anywhere else in the Bible. But I think it may have relevance here. Zechariah chapter 7. Actually, I'm going to say just a little bit more after this. Wave me down, please, if I'm pushing it too far here. Zechariah chapter 7. Remember Zechariah's time. Zechariah prophesied concurrently with Haggai. These men are prophesying after the captivity. The temple had been destroyed, and now the Jews are rebuilding the temple. Haggai got them back on it. Zechariah comes along to give them some encouragement. So the temple, which has been in desolation now for nearly 70 years, is about to be completed. Now the Jews had done something very interesting. Zechariah reveals this to us. While in captivity, the Jews had started four separate fasts. They had started a fast commemorating the day that the siege of Jerusalem began. They had started a fast commemorating the day the walls were breached, the day the temple was destroyed, and another with the death of Gedaliah, one of the governors. They had started these fasts, and every year they had observed these fasts. Now, who started these fasts? I just said it, but who started them? They did. They did. We have no indication at all anywhere in the Bible that God commanded them to start these fasts. From all appearances, they started them. Now notice what happens here in verses 1 through 3. In the fourth year of King Darius, it came to pass that the word of the Lord came to Zechariah on the fourth day of the ninth month, Chislev, when the people sent Sharezer with Regem Melech and his men to the house of God to pray before the Lord, and verse 3, to ask the priests who were in the house of the Lord of hosts and the prophets, saying, should I weep in the fifth month and fast as I have done for so many years? The fifth month was just one of these. Others are mentioned elsewhere in the book. Now, who started these fasts? They did. But now, when the temple's about ready to go up, and of course the temple's one of the things they've been fasting and mourning, the temple's about ready to go up, they're wondering, well, should we keep doing this? And so they go to Jerusalem to ask the priests and the prophets whether or not they should stop. What's wrong with this picture? Or do we see anything wrong with this picture?
There's no commandments to
All right. And since there's no command to keep to do it, if you don't want to do it, what? You stop. But how long have they been doing this? Maybe around there. And so one generation started it. They passed it down to their kids. Maybe their kids passed it to their kids. And we've been doing it so long now that what do we think? We're going to have to get God's permission to stop. What was man's idea has now become suddenly part of our required religion. I think that may be, in some cases, and I don't want to do injustice to those who may feel very strongly about this issue of clothing, but I do think that perhaps in some cases that's really at the root of it. That this is how I received my religion, and I want to keep my religion the way I got it, and that's what I was taught, and so that must be what's right. Even though God, as far as I can see, gave no direct command concerning it. Notice God's answer to them. Then the word of the Lord of hosts came to me, saying, verse 5, say to all the people of the land and to the priests, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh month during those 70 years, did you really fast for me? For me? You were doing all this fasting and mourning. Oh, we've lost the temple. Oh, the city was taken. Oh, Gedaliah was killed. And all that while, you were going through this religious ceremony, but who are you really doing it for? It was a pity party. It was a self-centered religious experience. It had nothing to do with me. Now, it could have, but it didn't. And maybe Dolores' remark early on has some truth to it. You know, I just feel better about church service when everyone's all dressed up. It makes me feel like we're doing something important. Maybe, you know, we've got these reasons, but in some cases they have nothing to do with God. I'm going to end with one thing. I think this issue of clothing is related, is a symptom of one problem and the cause of another, but we're not going to get to the second thing. I think it's a symptom of a problem we have had a huge problem with for quite a long time. And I know I'm a young man to be saying that, but I still think I'm right. Because I've talked with people and I've observed a little bit. And that is that